Hello again, and welcome to the 38th episode of the 905 podcast with me, Roland Tanner.
I am Joel McLeod.
And for our Thursday episode this week, we're going to kind of lead off from our Tuesday episode with Alyssa Briley on the evictions that are happening in Toronto at the moment, and look into slightly the wider issue of housing affordability. Based on some recent articles and some local news here in Burlington that's happening at the moment. So we spoke, Joel, with Alyssa, and one of the things I think we actually spoke about it off air after we finished recording was something that goes by the exciting name of the name's just gone out of my head. Inclusionary zoning, that's the word. Inclusionary zoning is something that sounds deadly boring, but it's something with a lot of potential for maybe finding a way to get affordable housing in at a proper proportion built into new developments. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about that, and it's basically, you know, you say to a developer, sure, you can build your 30-story building, but we want a percentage to be guaranteed affordable units in perpetuity. Seems like a good idea. Just sort of in connection with that, the news is coming out at the moment. Something that's been anticipated for a long time in Burlington is by Burlington standards, certainly a huge development is coming, beginning to come to council. That will be built on Burlington's sort of main thoroughfare, Fairview Street, near the closest to downtown GO station. An area of land that used to be kind of car lots and is certainly, I would say, suitable for development. And the city's had its eye on it for a long time. And we're looking at something like a proposal for up to 7 residential towers, some with mixed use, so they would have stores and commercial property in the bottom, residential above, 2,494 residential units of mixed type and tenure, so there might be some rental commercial space. And we thought we'd just look at this within the context of the affordable housing issue and the arguments that are made on the developer side about what they should be allowed to do within our cities at the moment. So, I don't know, Joel, what's your thoughts on this huge issue I've just outlined?
Yeah, it's a huge issue, and it's, I don't think there's a slam dunk answer to any of the issues. I would say, coming off our conversation with Alyssa, I thought it was enlightening. One of the things I asked her at near the end of the podcast was about a tsunami of evictions that are becoming our way if everything is left to stand as they currently are. I think it's going to be a huge problem, a huge detriment to recovering our, not just our provincial, but our national economy as well. That you can't have people going back into work as normal if they're now couch surfing or apartment hunting. And let's face it, across the 905, not just Burlington, but the 905 as a whole, apartments are scarce. We haven't really been building apartment buildings in the last 2 decades. It's all been condo developments. And that's a whole other can of worms in terms of you're not really renting from a company. You're renting usually from one person or maybe a group of people who own a few. They bought them as investment properties and they're renting it out. And that's all well and good. Good for them. And that's, yeah, I have no problem with that. But if that's the rental industry at the moment, then it's just people buying condos and townhomes and whatnot for rental income. Do we have a lot of inventory on the market to house people? Not to mention, is it affordable? Is it affordable to low-income moderate income people looking to make a looking for a place to live. And it's just like, I mean, it's just a whole mess of different problems all going to come together in a like a perfect storm at some point down the road. And I think we need to start looking at it now to really mitigate the situation. Which is why you and I had this discussion kind of offline, and I wanted to bring it up on this episode about the idea of inclusionary zoning, which I didn't know was that name until you brought it up. But basically, yeah, the idea is you tell a developer, okay, yeah, we're just going to sign off on your project. So you're going to build in a neighborhood, you're going to build a townhome development or a condo tower or whatever. Great, wonderful. We need them. But, you know, 10%, 8%, you know, a fixed number, a small percentage of it are thrown into a social housing pool. And my idea was that the province would mandate to every municipality in the province, you must create, if you don't already have one, you must create a municipal housing corporation, which these units would then be turned over to. And like, yeah, 10% of this project that we're talking about now. Well, not, how many units were in there?
In this, was it 1,200, something like that? Okay, so I'll get you the number.
Okay, like 1,200 units.
Actually, sorry, more than that. 2,400 units.
2,400. So I mean, 10% is a fraction of that, and you could offset the cost of that by selling the units. Like you just incorporate the loss, if you will, of those 10% in the cost of the other units. Nobody's going to notice the difference, and you're selling it off. You don't have to pay it off over time. You just sell it off, or you're mandated to give them to the Municipal Housing Corporation, to which then they themselves would have to figure out a way to rent them out. They would be the landlord. They would own those units. They would be involved in the condo board as the landlord or the owner of those units, and they would then lease them out, sublet them, rent them out to people of moderate or low income. And this would, I think, would help. I think would have a myriad effect on the housing market as a whole. I think it would bring down, help solve the housing issue somewhat. It's not a magic bullet. It's not going to solve it all, but I think it would bring down the housing homelessness issue somewhat as a solution. And two, it would help maybe start to curb the runaway housing prices that we're seeing in the 905. Because we keep hearing, oh, it's a supply and demand problem. Well, yeah, if people who are qualified for low income and medium income support are removed from competing in the pricing market. And my hope is that it would start maybe cooling the runaway pricing that we're seeing in the housing market for, you know, condos and townhomes and whatnot. I'm not an economist, so I'm not going to say that's my solution. But at the very least, it would help find homes for families who need it. And the third thing is, the other fear that people have is if you set up these low income housing projects, that's the fear. It's like you're going to see what you had in the inner cities in America of just these housing projects where people just move in there and they're stuck there. There's no mobility. It's not a stopgap solution. It's you put poor people essentially into ghettos and you hide them away. And you don't have to worry about them. That would stop this because they wouldn't be hidden away. They would be in our communities. They would be participating, vibrant members of our community as a whole.
Yeah, I was actually in the interview with Alyssa. I think I mentioned at one point the very different experience in Europe and just when I was growing up in Britain with what we call council housing. And by and large, very good thing, certainly provides a ready supply of affordable housing. But when these things were built in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that notion of you build an estate, you put the poor people on it was very central to the kind of thinking. You can imagine the problems that can cause when you separate out populations by income like that. So you can end up with sink estates and all kinds of other social ills. There's actually a town in Britain called Livingston that was built by it was a planned new city, and I think it's Livingston. Or there's a number of cities, but one of them in particular, they designed it so that each street would have the different strata of society on it. So you might have a doctor earning a good income, and when the city was built, a coal miner at the other end. And it's actually been shown to work fairly well. Now, since then, the city has grown and changed, and that plan has gone by the wayside. But I believe there were some studies on it that actually showed that it worked, that when you take away these artificial distinctions based on how much someone earns, it's healthier for communities as a whole. And when you think about it, that seems completely obvious, and it's what happened in our towns and cities for thousands of years before they grew to the scale that they are now. Now, the inclusionary zoning is something, when I was sort of involved with the city over the last couple of years, it was something that I was very interested in, because it seems like a kind of win-win for everybody, pretty much.
Yeah, that's what I viewed it as, is, you know, developers get to build the projects that they want to, and quite frankly, and we need development to continue. The problem is, you know, developers don't have there's not really an incentive to build ghettos, essentially, you know, just like, you know, these blocks of townhomes where the plan is, let's put all the poor people and forget about them.
It's another question I maybe should have asked, or we maybe should have asked Alyssa, because she'd be more of an expert on it. But to my mind, if you expect the market to provide, which is the kind of North American mentality in housing, it has to come from the market. Developers will build. I'm not sure that anywhere in the world is there a good example of the market providing affordable, low-income housing. It doesn't, because why would you? There's no the building industry has no interest in building things that are cheap.
Well,
they're trying to make money, you know.
Well, the problem with the market provides mentality is it's not necessarily what the market will provide the most affordable. The market will provide the most expensive within a given jurisdiction. Like that's why you have these. Every now and again, you open up the Globe or the Toronto Star or whatever paper, and they'll say, hey, what does $1 million buy you in terms of housing around the world? Well, if it's a free market, you know, $1 million should buy you the same size lot, no matter what. Like the cost of the unit shouldn't fluctuate based on the free market. Like you should, like $1 million here in Burlington will buy you a condo with a nice view of the lake down by the waterfront. $1 million on the East Coast is going to buy you a gorgeous estate with your own private beach. So don't tell me like, oh, the market will provide, because that doesn't, you know, what happens is you lose so much on the side. Like there's a big issue of that pricing structure forcing out young families, forcing out, you know, you don't have the generational turnover. You have just essentially you have like the old, as you said, the old rich white doctors moving out of Toronto, moving out here to the burbs, and then you force out all the young families that, you know, you want them to sit there and make their lives there. You want them to build and be entrepreneurs and build careers and whatnot, not the retirees looking to dump their nest egg.
Yeah. I mean, I think what the market does very successfully is the market's very good at making profits for people, which is fine. I'm not necessarily against that, but it's also very good at stratifying. It's very good at getting all your poor people to live in one place and all your rich people to live in another. I don't think that's healthy. It's not even convenient for, you know, we need people to work in, you know, skilled trades and working class jobs. And we need people who are lawyers and all that other stuff. in every city. We don't want to separate them out. So we've got, well, like you said, a kind of ghettos and walled cities of rich people. That's what we're seeing in places like Burlington, Oakville, right now, for sure. I think that it's becoming a kind of retirees' privilege to live here. Now, I mean, I have seen developers at council meetings talk so often about, well, you have to let us build this because we need housing affordability. If you don't let us build, then the prices will go up. And yet I came across an article from a gentleman that I mentioned last week. I'm going to mention him again, Dave Wilkes, president and CEO of Build, which is the, let me make sure I get this right, the Building Industry and Land Development Association. Who seems to have a regular column in various Star newspapers, which, you know, that's nice. We'd all like a column in the Star. It's surprising that an industry lobbyist would have such a regular appearance. But on the one hand, you have the building industry saying, you've got to let us build because we've got to have more housing and we need to make sure things are affordable. So they're trying to tick those boxes that make councillors and politicians feel good. And then in this article from the 20th of November, Mr. Wilkes talks about affordable about inclusionary zoning. Building affordable housing requires true partnership, he says. Well, that sounds all very nice. But then he gets onto inclusionary zoning. It's a laudable goal to encourage the development of more affordable housing. Unfortunately, the requirement, and he's talking about Toronto here, in Toronto's draft policy framework, so onerous that they will act as a disincentive and may, in fact, worsen the housing supply situation in what is already one of Canada's most constrained markets. And in essence, this comes down to the fact that they're being asked to give too many units and that they're being asked to pay for them. And that already, if I could find the line in the article, I would tell you, but there are already far too many burdens on developers. Well, the burdens that are put on developers by cities, the various fees that are charged, do not cover the fees in any city in Ontario, as far as I know, do not cover the actual cost to the city of that building being built. So, you know, the things that the city will have to do in terms of sewerage and services and all the other things. So development does not pay for itself. It used to be a myth that greenfield developments were encouraged by cities because it was a good way to expand the tax base. It doesn't actually work like that. And greenfield developments are some of the most expensive areas for cities to serve and maintain because they're so spread out. You've got to have even more sewerage and services to cover these large, spread out, sprawling estates. So this is baloney. You know, we're in effect subsidizing developers to build. They're constantly asking for more changes to the law to allow them to build more easily. And another article by the same author, he has been basically calling on the municipalities to sort of shape up, because now that Premier Ford has provided these legislative changes that they've been asking for, now it's only the municipalities who are standing in the way and stopping the developers doing what they need to do. Again, it strikes me as a strange kind of op-ed, a strange kind of writing that is.
I think, but going back to our conversation that we had with Alyssa previous episode, things need to change. Like I've said this before on this podcast. I've said it before in private. Like, if when you step back, like, COVID has kind of shone a light on the things that aren't working in our society. We've been building developments for decades now with the idea, oh, it'll bring down costs. It hasn't, but you know, we're not building the right kind of developments. You know, there are no rental options. Which, I mean, I look at this is anecdotal evidence, but I'm sure it's something that I'm hoping our listeners are going to sympathize with. But my parents are retired, and they had plans to sell their home and for a nice little sum, and then move into find a nice small little apartment that they'd rent, and they just pay a fixed rent for the rest of their days, and they'd live off the spoils of a life well lived and the investment from their home, and that's how they would live. I'm sure that's how it's supposed to work, right? That's the plan. Is you live a long life, you work hard, you reach a point where you retire, and the house that you've been investing in and upkeeping for decades, you sell it and you live off the sale for well into your twilight years, and beyond. That's not the case anymore. My parents sold their house to try and look for, they started looking for a rental accommodation that was within their budget. Nice. Like, they didn't want to just take anywhere. They wanted, and rightfully so. And it's just, it was sad because my wife and I told them, like, good luck. If you find a place that you can rent that is good and has vacancy, good. Good luck to you. Don't tell anyone. Cause it's it's a mad fight out there for rent. There's nobody's renting unless you get in, like I said before in this episode, unless you get into the condo rental game. And then that's a whole other can of worms that you're going to have to deal with. And, you know, the free market has not filled this need. I believe there's a huge market out there of retirees who say, I don't want to buy another property. I don't want to own something to have to upkeep and whatnot. I just want to pay. I want to pay a rental fee. I want to rent a nice 2-bedroom apartment somewhere and live out the rest of my days there. I don't need a big house for 4 or 5 people anymore.
Well, and it can lead to the kind of situation where, and one of the challenges we're facing with an aging population is quite naturally, many seniors don't want to leave their homes that they've paid. Many people don't want to do what your parents do and downsize. Many people want to stay exactly where they are because they like their home. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is another thing, kind of putting a restriction on the market, that you'll have one person living in a big house and a young family
that's the problem, is that you have these young families moving to the 905, and they're stuck renting basement apartments, they're stuck renting townhomes that are meant for, like, essentially newlyweds just to earn some capital, and then you move in. The idea is you're then move into the new, like the bigger home for your family. When the first child, the second child come along, you sell your small starter home and you move into the family home. That doesn't happen. The market doesn't provide that anymore. And I know that because my situation in my house. The house that I'm living in now was not the house we were supposed to be living in right now. The plan was always, when our children arrived, we were going to sell this house and move into a bigger house to accommodate a growing family. We tried to look in that, and the problem was we can't afford anywhere to move anymore. If we want to move, we're moving down to Niagara Falls, and no offense to Niagara Falls. At this point, no, I don't want to move there. We're lucky that we like our neighborhood. We like our neighbors. The house itself is a good house. And we like the school that my children are in. But, you know, this is the state. And I think Melissa brought up is that we are facing with a market failure. We're told the market would provide the need or provide the demand. And it hasn't. Like, I think the developers are way behind on demand at the moment.
Yeah, and they are, because there's no benefit to them in building something that reduces the price of housing. Let's face it. Last thing they want to do is reduce the value of the property they're selling. So they're never going to build prices low. That makes no sense. I can't think of anywhere in the world where the market has built quality, low-income housing without governments saying – build some high quality low income housing. In Burlington, there's a number of good housing co-ops. There's also a couple of less good ones. But they're a dying breed because they tend to be on land that the developers would really like to get their hands on to build condos. There's a really good example of that on the lakeshore right now, opposite Joe Brandt Hospital, that a way for people to buy property in Burlington who are on more moderate incomes existed there. You could buy into that co-op at a frankly quite surprisingly low price. But that will be gone soon and will become a very high-priced seniors residence. Again, I'm not saying that this is all within the rules as they exist at the moment. So I'm not suggesting anybody's doing anything wrong. I'm suggesting that it's regrettable when the small amounts of affordable housing stock that we have are going away and not being replaced. But those housing co-ops were created with the help of government, with serious incentives to do that kind of thing. You know, the market builds slums if it builds at all for low income people. Think of back to backs in Europe, the favelas in Mexico,
right? Places like and, that. Yeah, down Brazil.
You have to have regulation, or you get slums. And no one, why would you ever consciously set out to build houses for people who are not going to pay as high a price as other people would do? The government has to get involved. The sort of 20-year, is it 20 years or almost getting on for 25-year sort of moratorium on government involvement in housing has brought us to this point. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Again, the big reassessment that maybe we need after COVID needs to include this. And it doesn't have to be, you know, when we talk about governments doing things, I mentally hear every conservative in Canada rolling their eyes and going, here's another bloody liberal writing checks with his mouth that he doesn't want to pay.
But here's the thing, like we don't have to do, this isn't a hypothetical. Like we're seeing right now, there's no affordable housing being built in this country. And right now it's proving to be, it's not a poor person issue. It's not a place to house poor people. It's now affecting us in real time. Our housing prices are going up because affordable housing is not there in the market. The result has been highly inflated housing prices in the 905 region and other regions in the country, especially in Toronto. The market hasn't corrected itself. The market has not plateaued this. It has just gone up and up and up. Right now, I think the only solution, the problem is, they are right. There is not enough supply to meet the demand. The developers can't build the supply fast enough. They don't want to build the supply that's needed to bring this down. So you're right. Government needs to step in. What I think is going to exacerbate the situation is, as we discussed on Tuesday, the wave of evictions that are going to happen after the current moratorium on housing evictions or tenant evictions is lifted. There'll be people who just can't pay rent. Their jobs are we're in lockdown right now. Their jobs are not being worked at. Their paychecks not being cashed, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're gonna see a lot of people being evicted in 2021. Unfortunately, unless the government steps in and just says nope, you can't evict them. Yeah, everybody has to renegotiate a payment structure or whatever. Which I'll be honest, I don't see this government doing. I think we're going to be faced with a huge, huge problem, and especially in the light of the fact that we want to rebuild an economy, that we need both the federal and the provincial governments need an economy that's going to rebound quickly, that is going to be able to adapt to a new style of economics, to start paying down the massive debt that we've racked up due to COVID. you know, this we got to start thinking outside the box here. And I'm sorry, but the ideology of, oh, the market will provide, the market doesn't give a crap about us. The market doesn't. It's going to, it will make money off our backs if we let it. And we need a government to step up. And that's why I like the idea of the inclusionary policy. Developers want to build, and this is an easy way to start filling that void, and to just at least get the demand, sorry, the supply up there. There might be other solutions down the road that we can talk about, but I think for right now it's an easy one, and I don't think it requires any from the provincial government. It doesn't require any extra spending on their part, which is why I brought it up. It's just a change in the law. And you have the Minister of Municipal Affairs come in and say, no, we're going to pass it. If you don't have one already, every municipality, you know, of a given size must create a municipal housing corporation. And then just say to developers, just put in provincial law, every building that is made, that's built in Canada, or in Ontario, I'm sorry, must incorporate, you know, 5 or 10% of the units must be social. And then here's the other kicker to make sure that, you know, we're not getting cheated out. Their 5 or 10% unit, the Municipal Housing Corporation gets first pick. They go in and they get first pick of those, that 5, 10%, whatever it was. So it was one unit or two or three or four or however many, they get first pick of them. That way we know that they aren't going to be the ones that are haphazardly made. And that to me would be a quick and easy fix without having to cost the taxpayer any money.
You know, and this whole thing, you know, when we talk about municipal housing corporations and things like this, this doesn't need to be a tax burden. There's no reason why housing, you're renting, you know, it's just that the municipality becomes the biggest landlord in the region. That's all it is. The people still pay a decent rate. It may be subsidized in cases of people with very low incomes, but for most people, they're paying a fairly going rate for where they're going to be living. This doesn't need to be something where, well, we're going to have to support this with huge amounts of tax. I mean, it could even be something that, you know, you can work on these systems with developers so that, you know, so that it works in everybody's interest. I mean, I'm sure there is a way to partner with developers, but they tend to talk about partnership and then they say things like, and to quote this article from the Star by Mr. Wilkes, inclusionary zoning contributions are only the latest of many government-imposed fees, taxes, and charges that new developments attracts. Charges, parkland dedication, and other levies support infrastructure, transit, police, fire, and ambulance services, and social services such as childcare and affordable housing. Yeah, absolutely. That's why you pay for it, because you're building that stuff, and as part of building those properties, you are bringing all those costs. The industry, as currently constituted and with basically one particular party willing to give them what they want whenever they ask for it, is always going to be wanting to ask to support less and less of the burdens that they create through development. Now, we need housing, but we also need all the other things that go along with housing. And, you know, I'm not seeing developers going broke, and I'm not seeing them not building. I believe the GTA has some of the highest rates of building and development in North America, despite all the claims about, you know, municipalities standing in the way and so on and so forth. But we certainly need more. We need more of the right kind. And that's absolutely
what we're not getting. It should be building what the municipalities need and want, not telling the municipalities we want to build. If the municipality says, well, we need housing, but we want a condo tower of X number of units, well, why is it that nobody can build that? You know, and to say, well, we want a new neighborhood here or there. Okay. Why is it the developer has to ask, like, we want to build here. We want to buy this to build it. Well, you can buy it, but we're not allowing you to build anything there. Like we don't see the need. If you're going to build it, you build what we need.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the way the municipality is meant to work. That's why we have official plans. That's why we have planners to get the right housing in the right places. But at every point along the way, the city says, this is what we need. And the developers say, this is what we want to build. Let's fight over it. I mean, the whole system is based on conflict, which doesn't help anybody. And in that regard, I do have some sympathy for developers because it's a nightmare of a system and it's built on both sides fighting out to find some kind of solution. Where I disagree is that the developers have by far the whip hand in almost every point along the process, to the extent that municipalities really have been sidelined in this whole thing. Taking this development that's proposed in Burlington, it's Molinaro is a big local developer, for anyone who doesn't know. And I mean, I actually think it's not the worst proposal that I have seen in Burlington. Well, I would say it's I don't know
where it is. I know where you're talking about. It's a spot that really is primed for high-rise development, in my opinion. It is pretty much right next door to a GO train stop. And quite frankly, I mean, the majority of people in the 905 commute in and out of Toronto. It's a prime spot. I mean, if you are a young up and coming professional, a yuppie, yeah. I mean, why wouldn't you buy a unit in there? And literally, like, you wake up, roll out of bed, and roll onto the GO train, and you're into your job in Toronto in a short half hour express train.
I don't disagree. I would say I am entirely in favor of density in housing. Mm-hmm. I think if I have an objection to height along that part of town, it's not so much that I have a religious objection to height as I have a religious objection to lack of imagination. That these are tall buildings, stick as many people in, walk away.
Right.
They are required to put commercial space in, so they will put commercial space in. In recent years, commercial space tends to be units suitable for hairdressers and accountants. They tend not to attract the kind of commercial space that the cities actually want, like independent stores, businesses, and live-work units. I mean, a large part of what we're trying to do with intensification is to not assume that everybody's going to jump on the train, but actually give people the means to live and work in Burlington. Now, it is right by a train line, and we're not going to, you know, but again, COVID has taken everybody off the train. No one wants to be on a train at the moment. The world is changing somewhat.
Let's face it. Like, I think a lot of our shopping habits are going to change very much over the next couple of years because of COVID. You know, we're going to see a lot more online retail as opposed to the need for retail shops. So the idea we need commercial space in like a storefront boutique is a little outdated. It's already a bit outdated in my opinion, but this is a case where, you know, we just a little imagination, I think, could go a long way to create that. And I would intrigued, like, if it's 2,400 units and throwing a few units in there to be, social assistant housing, that would go along a huge way to help alleviate the need for affordable housing in this city.
Yeah. I mean, if you did say 10%, that'd be 240 units. That would be, right, quite transformational. I mean, traditionally how this kind of deal has gone down in Burlington, certainly, you wouldn't be talking about 5 or 10%. You'd be talking about 5 or 10 units. Now, in a smaller development than this, so, well, I mean, this will be more affordable than other parts of town as well, because no one's going to be retiring to live by the railway line. So, well, it's unlikely people are going to want to retire to live next to the railway line. So there's some good things about this, and it is a site that I think is entirely appropriate for dense, for intensification and for a fairly high density of property. I just sometimes wish, and when you look at the lot layout of this site, it's like, wow, they're already doing a lot of density because you've got seven towers. About 50%, if not 60% of the land will be not built on, because that's what you have to have when you build a tower. See, for every tower, you end up with space that has to exist surrounding it. Could you not, and this is an argument I've seen many times, you know, build something that is a number of stories lower, but it is more imaginative, is more, it's kind of a cliche, but a human scale that maybe doesn't go above 10 stories, but has exactly the same number of units. But I suspect that kind of thing is more expensive to build. These kind of designs that they do now, I mean, it seems to me you can pretty much pull off the shelf and drop down. You know, they all look very much the same. They all have the same kind of architectural designs on them. It's boring, you know. Well, it's going to be interesting hearing listeners' opinions on this. I mean, to say this has been a controversial subject in Burlington over the last decade is an understatement. This is certainly the kind of thing that many people suggested would be a better solution. Do you think that now this has come along, it is a better solution? If we all agree that we have to have housing, where would you put it in your city, whether you live in Burlington or anywhere else? We'd love to hear your opinions. And that's probably a good point to leave it off, Joel. I think outside of COVID, how we plan our cities, how we make the 905 cities more distinct and more places we can kind of be proud of and, that we don't think of them as dormitory towns anymore. That we think of them like, I live in a city called Mississauga, or I live outside Toronto. That should be, I think, a key kind of priority over the next 10, 20 years, to turn this region into something that has its own character, has its own distinctness, and where we haven't just taken the easy, lazy option all the time, because so that we end up with just something that could be anywhere in North America. It's as usual, I'm far too idealistic probably for what will actually happen, but I would like to have those conversations as part of what we do on this podcast.
Why don't we leave it to our listeners, and hopefully they'll let us know what they think about this.
Great. Okay. Thanks, everybody. And we'll be back next week with more episodes of the 905er.
Take care. That's it for this episode of the 905er. Thank you for listening. As always, you can send us your feedback, thoughts, and concerns, or ideas for future episodes to our email, info@905er.ca. We'd love to hear from you. You can help us keep the 905er going by financially supporting us through Patreon as well as PayPal. Visit us at 905er.ca and click on the support tab. As well, links are in the show notes for your convenience. Lastly, you can find us on social media. Search for the_905er on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. So long for now. See you next time.
Hi, I'm Emily Roger, and I host a leadership show called The Boiling Point with my co-host, Dave Vail. Together, we sit down with trailblazing entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and movement makers who are driving meaningful change in our world. The show is all about exploring the lives and perspectives of leaders who are making a difference. Join us for insightful conversations that challenge the status quo, spark new ideas, and inspire you to take action. Find us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or at BoilingPointPodcast.com.